Here, right now. Foley's eyes jerked from BW to Jake, and that's all it took. Foley's demons spilled out, though he smiled as he spewed. There's the man who fucked my wife.
Dad, please lower your voice.
Jake had stopped in his tracks. Foley eased off his stool and steadied himself. BW moved swiftly and locked his arms around Foley's so he couldn't move. Foley raised his voice to a shrieking pitch.
You son of a bitch! Admit it! You used my wife and then you cast her aside like she was common as dirt. You never even had the decency to own up to it.
That's it, BW said. He lifted Foley and force-marched him through the bar. You ever set a foot in here again, and it's the last thing you'll ever do. I'm warning you. In BW's grip, Foley's feet scarcely touched the floor. He looked like a ballerina, up on his toes, taking light, dainty steps with remarkable speed and grace.
Warn me? Why not warn him? Why not warn every man in town has a wife as beautiful as mine? I'm telling you the truth, which he damn well knows.
Daisy grabbed BW's arm, and she was being dragged along at the same quick clip.
Stop it! Let go of him! He can't help himself!
Maybe I can help. Here, try this.
BW bumped the door open with his foot and flung Foley out. Foley landed on one hip, his momentum toppling him over onto his hands and knees. Before anyone could intervene, BW swung one boot back, and his fast-moving kick caught Foley squarely in the face. The cartilage in his nose went flat with a sound like a watermelon hitting concrete. Blood spurted out of his nose and his mouth welled with red. A row of white teeth, false, had popped out intact, but others were damaged and his tongue seemed swollen as though he'd bitten himself. His eyes rolled back in his head until all we could see were two white slits. Then he went still. Daisy screamed. My heart was knocking against my chest so hard I thought I'd see bruises the next day. Daisy dropped down beside her father, who groaned and rolled over on his back. She looked up at BW with horror, both of us expecting a second kick to land. BW turned away. He grabbed the door, and his tone was filled with disgust.
Fuck! I'll call an ambulance and send out some ice for his face.
Chapter 23. The ambulance arrived, and three paramedics alighted like firemen on a run. By then, Foley had staggered to his feet and was ready to fight the son of a bitch who'd knocked him on his buns. He was belligerent, lashing out, fending off the paramedic who was offering first aid. With the blood oozing out of his nose and welling across his upper lip, he looked like a vampire interrupted in the course of a gory feast. The waitress brought him a plastic bag packed with ice and wrapped in a kitchen towel. Grimacing, she passed it to him and returned to the restaurant as quickly as possible. While his upper bridge had gone flying, his lower teeth had been forced through his lip. He held the ice pack to his mouth, the towel turning a saturated red. He declined medical attention, so the paramedics had no choice but to climb back into the ambulance and drive away. Foley slumped onto the wooden steps and leaned his head against the rail, talking to himself. Daisy bent over him.
Dad, listen to me, would you listen? You need to see a doctor.
I don't need a doctor. Leave me be.
He scanned the area around him, his eyes out of focus.
Where'd my bridge go? I can hardly talk without my teeth.
Don't worry about that. I've got it. I need your keys.
He leaned sideways, nearly losing his balance as he dug in his pants pocket and came up with the keys. Daisy snatched them and passed them to me before she turned back to him.
I want you to get in the car. I'm taking you to the emergency room. Kinsey's going to follow us in your truck, and don't argue.
I wasn't arguing,
he said in a cranky, argumentative tone. We helped him to his feet. He was woozy from the whiskey and woozy from the blow to his face. The two of us guided him, staggering, to Daisy's car, which was parked on the street and mercifully close. She unlocked the passenger side door and opened it. Foley shrugged off any further help,
claiming he could manage. He held onto the doorframe, eased himself half the distance to the seat, and then fell the rest, groaning at the jolt. "It's your own fault," she snapped. "Move your hand." He managed to remove his hand from the frame half a second before she slammed the door. She opened the trunk and snatched a terrycloth towel from her gym bag. Disgusted, she opened the door again and tossed it to him. "Don't bleed on the upholstery." She pointed out his truck in the parking lot and then slammed the trunk lid shut as she rounded the back of the car. I walked over to the truck and let myself in while she started her car. She waited until I was nosing out of the parking lot before she put her car in gear and pulled onto the street ahead of me. She drove him to the ER at the hospital where she worked. By that time, Foley had settled down, perhaps recognizing the enormity of his sins. Even having his nose broken wasn't going to be sufficient penance to redeem him in Daisy's eyes. She put his name on the register, and when he was called, she accompanied him into the examining room. I sat in the waiting room, leafing through a magazine while Foley was being worked on. After 40 minutes, she came out and sank into the chair next to mine. I said, "How's it going?" "He'll be fine. They've called in an ear, nose, and throat specialist to reset his nose. The doctors also ordered a CAT scan since he suffered a brief loss of consciousness. They said they'd bring me in again when he's back from radiology." "Will they keep him overnight?"
"Doesn't look that way," she said as she got up. "Let me see if I can find a payphone and call the pastor. There's no way I'm taking him home with me."
She took her purse and headed off down the hall. Less than 5 minutes later, she was back.
"Blessings on the man. He asked a few questions and then said he'd be waiting whenever Dad was released. The parish house is right next door to the church, and he says he's welcome as a guest as long as he needs help. I don't know where he'd be if it weren't for that man."
Friday night was apparently the equivalent of date night in the ER world, a popular occasion for accidents and mishaps, pain, suffering, and near-death experiences. A kid was brought in with a bean stuck up his nose. There was a woman hacking and feverish from a case of the flu, and a man with a sprained ankle swollen to elephantine proportions. A teen arrived holding his badly broken thumb, smashed by a car door and looking so mangled I nearly passed out. Unfazed, Daisy pulled the clip out of her hair and gathered it in a tidy sheaf before she secured it again. Foley's accusation about Jake's affair with Violet seemed to hang in the air between us.
"All I can say is thank God Tanny wasn't there."
"She's bound to hear about it," I said.
"You bet.
My phone would be ringing off the hook if anybody knew she was there." I set the magazine aside. You have to wonder what went on. Was there really an affair? Or did your dad imagine the whole thing?
He's not famous for his imagination. Tanny's mother was sick for a good 2 years. It was female trouble, too. So there's every possibility their sex life sucked.
She shook her head and let out a deep breath. She extended her legs and slouched down on her spine so that her head was resting on the back of the seat.
Was there anyone she didn't screw? My mother must have been crazy as a loon.
Well, it's like the fella said. You're not responsible for what she did.
But I'm responsible for stirring this up. I should have left well enough alone.
The big digital wall clock read 10:16. I got up, too restless to sit another minute in the midst of all the medical chaos. "I'm going to see if I can find a cup of coffee. You want one?"
"Not me. My nerves are jangled enough."
The fluorescent lights in the public hallways shone brightly on the gleaming vinyl tile floors. Most departments I passed were dark. Hospital administration, the cardiovascular, EKG, and EEG departments. I turned a corner and followed the corridor until I reached the main lobby. A sign indicated that the cafeteria was one floor down, but when I got off the elevator in the basement, the place was dark and the door was locked. According to the sign, the coffee shop was open from 7 a.m. until 7:15 p.m. on weekdays. I'd missed by hours. A maintenance man appeared with a mop and an industrial-sized bucket. Together, we waited for the elevator, which had stopped on the first floor. "Is there a vending machine around here?" He shook his head.
Wish there were. I could use a candy bar about now.
The elevator doors opened and we got on. When we emerged on the first floor, I glanced to my left and spotted Liza Clements sitting in the lobby. Her complexion looked washed out and her jeans and t-shirt were wrinkled. I called out to her and moved in her direction. "What are you doing here?" I asked. "My granddaughter was born a few minutes ago. I'm keeping out of everybody's hair until she's cleaned up. Kevin's upstairs with Marcy, and both of her parents are here. 6 pounds, 6 ounces. She's absolutely beautiful." "That's great. Congratulations." "Thanks. It's been pretty intense. What about you? I didn't expect to see a familiar face."
I gave her a quick rendition of Foley's nose-busting adventure, neatly omitting the remarks that had gotten him tossed out of the moon.
"Is there any way to get a cup of coffee at this hour?" she asked.
"Nope. I tried. I guess we could find a water fountain, but that's about it." We ended up sitting together in the main lobby for lack of any better place. It was a small, cheerless area, clearly not intended as a waiting room. At least the ER had offered a television set and a few live green plants. I said, "You heard about the car?"
"That's all anybody's talking about. I guess there's no doubt it's hers."
"Not in my mind.
I mean, what are the chances another car would be buried out where hers was last seen?"
She shifted in her chair.
"I'm going to fess up to something, but I don't want to hear you scream, you promise?"
"Scout's honor."
"As it so happens, I saw Foley at the Tanner property that Friday night."
"Doing what?"
"Tinkering with a bulldozer that was parked near the road. I heard him start it up."
"You're positive it was Foley?"
"I couldn't swear it was him, but who else could it be?"
"Just about anyone," I said.
"In the as-it-so-happens department, what were you doing there?"
"Ty and I had gone out to the house. We weren't supposed to be dating, and it was the only place we could think of where we wouldn't be seen. We were in that second-floor bedroom in front when we heard him drive up."
"And you were what? Smoking dope? Making out?"
She rolled her eyes, tucking a strand of blonde hair behind one ear.
"Oh, please, none of us smoked dope in those days. We're talking about the 50s. We were square as they come."
"So you were doing what?"
"Okay, we were necking, if you must know the truth. When the car pulled up, we thought it was a security guard coming to check on the house. So we hightailed it out the back and waited until we heard the dozer start up. Ty figured that would cover the sound of the truck."
"So you didn't actually see Foley face on?"
"I just told you that. The point is, if it was him, he had plenty of time to dig a hole."
"What kind of car? I'm assuming you'd have recognized the Bel Air."
"Of course. Most of the time I can't tell one kind of car from another, but I know it wasn't Violet's. Her car was pale, and it would have stood out. There was enough of a moon that it would have been obvious."
"What do you remember about the car? 2-door, 4-door, light, dark?" She made a face, shaking her head in the negative.
"I saw it, but I didn't really look. I was scared we'd get caught, and that was all I cared about. And before you even ask, no, I didn't tell the guys from the sheriff's department."
"Because you didn't want to admit you were trespassing?"
"Because at the time, it didn't mean anything. Violet wasn't even missing. When we saw the guy, Foley or whoever, it wouldn't have occurred to me he'd be doing anything like that. Digging a grave. God, it gives me goosebumps. I'm only telling you now because we know the car is buried there."
"You remember anything else?"
"No." "Well, yes. The guy was smoking. I remember that because we could smell it through the open window all the way upstairs."
"Height, weight, anything like that?"
"Nope. It was dark, and I only caught a glimpse."
"You think I should talk to the detective?"
"Absolutely," I said. "Even if it gets Foley in more trouble. You can't even claim it was him. All you can say is there was a guy out there working on a bulldozer.
The detective's name is Nichols. He needs to know." By the time I got back to the emergency room, Foley had been released. He emerged from the examining area, clutching a head trauma precaution sheet and the pain pills he'd been given to take home with him. His eyes were already looking bruised,
and I imagined that by the next day the purple would be intense. He had a splint taped over the bridge of his nose, and it made his eyes seem as close together as a collie's. Both nostrils had been packed with half-inch-wide strips of white cloth, and I could see sutures across his chin. I had to guess there were others on the inside of his mouth. Luckily for him, the pain medication was wiping out the ill effects of his drinking binge. He looked subdued. His eyes were fixed on Daisy's with the mute, pleading look a puppy lays on you when there are table scraps at stake. Daisy drove him into Cromwell, me trailing along behind in his truck as I had before. When she pulled into the driveway of the parish house, the porch light came on. The pastor pushed a curtain aside and peered out, then opened the front door in his slippers, pajamas, and a soft flannel robe. I parked in front, locked the truck, and crossed to Daisy's car, where I handed Foley his keys. He wouldn't meet my eyes, and I could feel the embarrassment rolling off him like sweat. The pastor held open the screen door, and Foley disappeared inside. Daisy had a few words with the man and then returned to her car. We got in. For a moment she sat staring through the windshield, her hands on the steering wheel. "You okay?" "I'll tell you what's weird. You know, when you see a movie, they have those previews of coming attractions? This feels like a preview of past attractions. I don't remember seeing my father drunk, but this has to be what he was like when he was married to my mom. Not nice." "Yeah, and I'll bet he looks about like she did when he beat the hell out of her." She turned the key in the ignition. "At least now you know why I'm so screwed up." "You know something, Daisy? You're not that screwed up. I've seen a lot worse." "Oh, thanks. I feel much better now that you've said that." We drove to Santa Maria in silence. The two-lane road was deserted at that hour, dark agricultural land stretching out on both sides as far as the eye could see. We passed a corrugated metal building, sitting in a sea of asphalt and surrounded by chain-link fencing. The area was awash in a cold silver light, but there was no sign of life. To the west, concealing the sight of the ocean beyond, a swell of low-lying hills formed a scalloped silhouette against the night sky. Daisy checked her rearview mirror as a set of headlights popped into view. I glanced over my shoulder, expecting the car to speed up and pass. Daisy was cruising at a sedate 60 miles an hour, but drivers on country roads get impatient. The car, behind us, maintained the same distance for a mile, and then began closing the gap. Daisy flicked another look in the mirror. "Shit. I recognize the Mercedes. That's Jake. How'd he know where we were? You think he was waiting in the ER parking lot?" "I didn't see him, if he was." We reached Santa Maria and turned down Daisy Street with Jake right behind us. He wasn't doing anything threatening, and he made no attempt to conceal himself, but in the wake of the violence, I wasn't crazy about seeing him again. BW might have delivered the kick, but Jake had been the catalyst. Daisy pulled into her driveway and doused her headlights. I checked the house. An overhead fixture burned in the kitchen, but the living room and guest room at the front of the house were both dark. Jake eased in behind us and doused his headlights. He killed the engine, as Daisy had, and then he got out and approached us along the drive. "You think we ought to get out?" she asked. I put a hand on the door handle. "Let's. I don't like the idea of his towering over us." She got out on her side, and I got out on mine, moving around the front of the car so we were side by side. It was dark, and the night was chilly, as anticipated, which made me happy I'd accepted the offer of a jacket. I crossed my arms, not feeling the cold so much as residual tension. The neighboring houses were locked and barred for the night. I wasn't uneasy about Jake, but it did occur to me that if either of us screamed, no one would hear us and respond. Daisy said, "Hey, Jake, what can I do for you?"
"Sorry to bother you. I stopped by to ask about your dad. Is he all right?"
"I wouldn't go that far, but the doctor treated him and sent him home, so I guess that tells you something. You know, you could have called instead of following us home like this."
"There's Something else I wanted to talk about, and I didn't think it should wait. I promise I won't take up too much of your time.
Good, because we spent the last 2 hours at the emergency room and I'm beat. Tanny's gone to bed if you were hoping to see her.
It's you I'd like to talk to.
You too, he said, with a quick nod at me. Why don't you come on in the kitchen and we'll close the door? I don't imagine you want Tanny hearing this.
Out here is fine. I intend to talk to her myself as soon as I have the chance. My son Steve, too.
Smart move, she said.
Jake ignored her testiness. I came to apologize for what happened to Foley tonight. We're fully prepared to pay his medical expenses. You can send the bills straight to me, and I'll take care of them. B.W. had no right to do what he did.
Shit, really? Kick a guy in the face and bust his nose?
Daisy, I said I was sorry, and I mean that. B.W. was way out of line, and I told him so. I'm not saying he was wrong to hustle your dad out of there. Foley had that coming, but not the violence. B.W.'s a hothead. He tends to act first and think about it later. It wouldn't surprise me if Foley pressed charges.
Forget it. He's not going to do that. So what else? I'm sure you didn't tail us to inquire about his health.
I feel I owe you an explanation.
Daisy nearly offered him a smart remark, but apparently decided against it. Better to let him fumble through the conversation on his own. Jake kept his gaze pinned on the middle distance, but his manner was otherwise straightforward.
It isn't true, what he accused me of, but I believe I know how he came by that impression, even if he's mistaken. I hope you'll bear with me.
Have at it. I'm all ears.
There was an incident at the moon. This must have been a month and a half before your mother disappeared. I'd been up at the hospital visiting Mary Harrell, and I stopped off for a nightcap. Both your parents were at the bar and had been for some time. I think it's safe to say neither one of them was feeling any pain. By the time I arrived, your dad was in a sulk. Violet started flirting with me, I think to aggravate him as much as anything else. My wife was sick, I was lonely, and maybe I gave your mother the wrong impression. We started dancing, which seemed harmless to me, but after a while she was behaving in a way that was an embarrassment. Communities, small. You know how it is. Everybody knows everybody's business. I couldn't have her rubbing up against me or putting her hands on my butt. Anyway, I'll skip the details out of respect for her. I didn't want to hurt her feelings, but I knew I had to set her straight. Problem was, Violet was accustomed to getting her way, and she wasn't about to take no for an answer. She got mad and said I'd insulted her. About then, she walked off the floor, and I followed her. I hadn't meant anything of the sort. I tried telling her it wasn't my intent. I liked your mother, don't get me wrong, but I was taken aback. Long and short of it, she ended up throwing a glass of wine in my face.
That was you? I'd heard the story, but I had no idea. Your name was never mentioned.
That was me, all right. Unfortunately, that wasn't the end of it. She started screaming and cussing. She was hot-tempered to begin with and sensitive to slights. She threatened to tell Foley we'd had sex, that I'd come on to her, and when she turned me down, I'd forced myself on her. Nothing could have been farther from the truth, but what could I do? B.W. could see something was going on, and he got Foley out of there on some pretext. Once he was gone, I tried to reason with her. I hadn't meant to offend her, and I apologized for any misunderstanding. She seemed to calm down. I hoped that would be the end of it, but I couldn't be sure. I was in a sticky position. I couldn't go to Foley and tell him what she'd said. If she never mentioned it herself, I'd only be opening up a can of worms. He'd either take issue with me for rejecting her, or else he'd accuse her of screwing around and she'd deny everything, claiming I'd raped her. In that case, I'd end up looking like my only interest was in covering my tracks. At any rate, I thought it best to keep quiet, and that's the last I heard of it, until tonight. Clearly, she did what she'd threatened. She must have told him I'd pushed her into something against her will, and that's what he believed. Daisy was quiet. I could see her testing his story in the same way I was.
I don't know what to say. Dad and I haven't talked about any of this. He's a mess right now, and I'm sure he's ashamed of himself for getting drunk. I do understand you're wanting to set the record straight. If you like, I'll tell him what you said.
I leave that to your judgment. At least now you know my side of it. You can believe it or not. And your dad, when he sobers up, can do with it what he wants. I don't mean any disrespect to Violet, but he knows how capable she was of turning things around. If he'd stop and think about it, he might be willing to concede the point. As for me, I'm sorry for any part I played. I never meant to cause him any grief.
I appreciate that, Jake. Is there anything else?
No, that's it. I've had my say. I know it's late, and I won't keep you.
The two of them went through a bit of conversational back and forth before Jake finally said his goodnights and returned to his car. Once he'd left, I waited half a minute and said, "What do you think?" "I've got no proof, but offhand I'd say the man is a lying sack of shit."
Chapter 24. Tom. Thursday, July 2nd, 1953. The morning after Cora left for Walnut Creek, Tom slept in, sprawled across the bed in a luxury of sheets. Among the many things they disagreed about was the temperature in the bedroom at night. He liked it cold, windows open to the wide, while Cora liked the windows shut and the heat cranked up. They also disagreed about blankets, the firmness of the mattress, and the nature of bed pillows. Alone, he could do it all exactly as he liked. With Cora out of the way, he was an entirely different man. It was like having a separate personality, one he called forth and wore like a smoking jacket while she was gone. He had two such personalities, as a matter of fact. When he drank, especially at the Blue Moon, he relaxed into the blue-collar type from which he sprang. He was a good old boy at heart. He liked his boots and jeans, adding a western-cut sport coat when he felt like dressing up. Here in Cora's fancy house, sober and unobserved, he activated another side of his nature, playing Lord of the Manor. He was jaunty and dapper. He used a cigarette holder when he smoked and affected a snooty accent when he talked to himself. He got up at 10, showered, dressed, and popped over to Maxie's coffee shop for breakfast. He checked on a couple of pieces of equipment that he had out, and when he reached the house again, he saw the mail truck just pulling away. He angled the car in close to the mailbox and retrieved the stack of envelopes and two of Cora's magazines. He left the car in the driveway and entered the house, calling, "Yoo-hoo! I'm home!" purely for the pleasure of knowing he was on his own. He carried the mail into Cora's office and laid it on the corner of her desk, intending to peruse later at his leisure. He sat down in her office chair and began a systematic search. She was secretive about her personal papers, keeping everything locked up. Desk drawers, file cabinets, even the closet where she kept her jewelry and furs. The good news was he'd long ago figured out where she hid the keys. It amused him to let her go on believing herself secure, while he kept an eye on her every move. He knew better than to try to siphon money from her bank accounts. She could be such a bitch about those things. But he did occasionally fudge an endorsement on a dividend check. One had arrived the day before, and he'd culled it out of the batch before he gave the mail to her. In his bathroom, with the door locked, he opened the envelope to see what his deception had netted him. $356.45 from some shares of stock she owned. He liked walking around money, just the odd few bucks. She never seemed to notice. Dividend checks came periodically, and the face amount varied, so it wasn't something she counted on as a regular event. He wasn't proud of himself, but he did enjoy his little forays into her private affairs. Really, she brought it on herself. He opened her desk drawer and found the folder in which she kept her canceled checks. He extracted one, pleased with the sample of her signature, Cora A. Paget, with a little loop on the last T. He had a nice supply of tracing paper, and he could whip out a decent approximation in no time at all. He endorsed the check.
Well, Cora A. Paget endorsed the check. And then he put his tools away and picked up the stack of mail. He sorted through rapidly, disregarding bills, except for the ones he didn't want her to see. The last envelope in the pile was a letter addressed to Loden Galsworthy from an out-of-state bank. He reached for the letter opener, slit the envelope, and read the correspondence signed by Lawrence Freiberg, one of two vice presidents. Mr. Freiberg, or Larry, as Tom was already fond of calling him, was writing to inquire about the above-referenced account on which there had been no activity for the better part of 5 years. Interest had been accruing and was, of course, properly credited, but the bank was wondering if perhaps there was something more they might do for him. They'd recently established an investment arm for valued customers. Since Loden Galsworthy was numbered among their very best, Mr. Freiberg suggested that perhaps the bank might put him in touch with one of their financial experts for an analysis of his portfolio. Tom read the letter twice. This had to be an account of Loden's that Cora had either overlooked or knew nothing about. Mr. Freiberg had probably never met his valued customer, and clearly had no idea he was writing to the deceased, the late Loden Galsworthy. When he turned to the next page and his eye settled on the account balance, he barked out a laugh. $65,490.66. He couldn't believe his good fortune. For weeks he'd walked around with his head in a noose, and suddenly he was free. He knew exactly what to do. He got up from the desk and crossed to the closet, where Cora maintained what amounted to a shrine to her dead husband's memory. Being the sentimental fool she was, she'd held on to a number of items that had belonged to him, among them his personalized stationery and his Mont Blanc fountain pen. Tom extracted an envelope, several sheets of letterhead, and a few pieces of blank paper. He then sat down at Cora's typewriter, Loden's before his death, and flexed his fingers, preparing himself as though for a piano recital. Using the blank paper and a bit of ingenuity, he composed a letter thanking the vice president for his concern. He confessed he'd been out of the country and had just returned to the States after 4 years away. Having the account brought to his attention was fortunate, as he was currently entertaining an investment opportunity for which the above-referenced funds would be swiftly set to work. He requested that the account be closed, and the money forwarded to him at the post office box he'd maintained during his absence. This was, in fact, a post office box that Tom had set up some time ago so that any private business of his wouldn't come under Cora's nose. He rolled a sheet of Loden's stationery into the typewriter and went to work. His typing was clumsy, but he managed to get a clean copy after 3 tries. If the bank had kept any previous correspondence from Loden Galsworthy, it might be noted that the typeface, the writing paper, and the fountain pen nib were all a match. Now all he needed was Loden's signature. On Cora's office wall there was a certificate of appreciation for work she'd done as a Red Cross volunteer in 1918, when she was 21 years old. It was a boilerplate document, hundreds of which must have been doled out to the women who'd donated thousands of hours of free labor. But she'd framed it, and hung it as though she were the sole recipient. Loden Galsworthy had been one of the 3 signatories. She'd told Tom that she and Loden often spoke of the amazing coincidence of this link between them before they'd even met. He took down the framed certificate and spent 20 minutes or so perfecting Loden's signature. Then he signed the letter, folded it, placed it in the envelope, and added a stamp. All in a day's work. He'd drop it in the mail on his way to the bank. This was truly a gift from the gods, an answer to his prayers. He felt incredibly light and free. He hadn't realized how anxious he'd been until the crisis had passed. Now he didn't have to worry about Cora's penury. No more wheedling, no more maneuvering. In one stroke, all his problems had been solved. As icing on the cake, his lunch with Chet Kramer the day before had gone very well. He knew Chet had agreed to listen to his pitch, only because he and Livia coveted membership in the country club, to which the Pagets belonged, but he thought his presentation had been effective. Chet had not only seemed interested, but he'd asked Tom to work up a business plan to pass on to his accountant. Tom intended to work on that shortly after lunch. He drove to the bank and made a deposit, tucking the forged dividend check in with some miscellaneous checks of his own. With the $65,490.66, that would soon be his. He no longer needed the measly $356.45, but he'd already forged Cora's signature, so why not proceed? He'd learned never to waste his efforts. Once he made a plan, he carried it out, a principle that had always paid off handsomely for him. He chatted with the teller, completed his business, and was just on his way out when he ran into the loan officer, Herbert Greer, who'd clearly made a point of intercepting him. Tom had been avoiding him because he knew the guy was going to press him for the money he owed. Now, with his newfound funds waiting in the wings, he greeted Greer like an old friend, shaking his hand with real warmth.
"Herb, how are you? I'm glad I ran into you."
Herb was clearly not prepared for Tom's friendliness after weeks of evasions and excuses. Herb said,
"I thought you were out of town. I left a couple of messages with Cora earlier this week, and when you didn't respond, I assumed you were off gallivanting around." "Not me. Cora's the one who's gone. She took off this morning to visit her sister up in Walnut Creek, naughty girl. She didn't mention you'd called. I had no idea. It must have slipped her mind." "No doubt. She's usually good about these things, but she was in a rush to get packed and on the road. Anyway, I was going to stop by your desk earlier, but I saw you were on the phone."
Herb was cautiously pleased at the suggestion, probably imagining he'd have to tackle Tom and bring him down before any such appointment would be made or kept.
"Why don't you have a seat at my desk, and we can do that right now?"
Tom looked at his watch, his expression tinged with regret.
"Can't! Daggone it! I'm having lunch at the country club with Chet Kramer, and I'm late as it is. I thought I saw you at the club with him yesterday." "True. I didn't realize you were there. You should have stopped by the table to say hello. I think I might have mentioned we're in discussions about a partnership. He knows the heavy equipment business, which he says isn't that different from a dealership."
"I had no idea you had a deal in the works. Good for you."
"Well, we've yet to hammer out the details, but you know him. There's a guy who takes his time. No point in pushing him. He likes to have all his ducks in a row before he takes the plunge. We've worked with Chet for years. He's solid as they come.
Tell you what, if we can reach an agreement, I'll bring him along and maybe we can talk about ways to make this thing work."
"Always amenable. I hope you'll give him my regards."
"Happy to.
Shall we say Monday, 10 o'clock?
"Perfect. I'll see you then."
And for the first time in his life, Tom left the bank feeling optimistic. As soon as Loden Galsworthy's money came in, he'd be able to expand. Now all he needed was another big whack of cash so he could pay off his bank loan on Monday. Chapter 25. By the time Daisy came out of her bedroom at 8 o'clock Saturday morning, Tanny had left for home. From my makeshift pallet on the couch, I had heard her come out of the guest room and creep into the bathroom, quietly closing the door. I must have dozed, because the next thing I knew, she was slipping through the living room with an overnight case in hand. Out on the street, I heard her car start, and then all was quiet again until Daisy got up. Tanny had stripped her sheets and left them on the guest room floor with her damp towel on top. Daisy shoved everything in the washing machine and then loaned me a pair of sweatpants so I could add my jeans to the mix. We took turns in the bathroom. I grabbed a quick shower while she started the coffee, and then I ate a bowl of cereal while she took my place. By 8:35, we were dressed, fed, and on our way to the Tanner property to check the progress on the excavation. We took her car, leaving mine in the garage. The day was clear and sunny, the air rapidly warming as we made the drive. The road was still blocked to through traffic, but the deputy waved us past the barrier when Daisy identified herself. I'd apparently been given dispensation to accompany her. We parked the requisite 25 yards from the dig and got out of the car. The sagging yellow crime scene tape trembled in the breeze with a light snapping sound. I recognized the faces from the day before, both crime scene techs, Detective Nichols, the young deputy, and Tim Schaefer, who'd made himself a permanent fixture, although confined to the periphery like the rest of us. Despite the restrictions, we hovered on the sidelines, as though magnetized. Conversations were restrained, and I noticed no laughter at all, unusual in a situation that generated an eerie tension of its own. Judging by the mountain of dirt, I could tell that the hole had been considerably deepened, and the operation had shifted from machinery back to shoveling by hand. From our vantage point, there was nothing visible of the vehicle, but I gathered a narrow channel had been created on each side, as additional sections of the car were exposed. Tom Paget stood as close to the excavation as he could manage without risking arrest. His bulldozer was on call, as was a flatbed truck that had been brought over from the yard, and he was behaving as though this gave him proprietary rights, which perhaps it did. When he wasn't focused on the excavation, he was chatting with Detective Nichols like an old pal of his. Calvin Wilcox was parked behind Daisy about 20 feet down the road. He'd arrived shortly after we had, and he was sitting in a black pickup truck with his company name emblazoned on the sides. He smoked a cigarette, his left arm resting on the open windowsill. I could hear his radio blasting country music. Like Daisy, he was permitted at the site by reason of his relation to Violet. There was no interaction between the two of them, which struck me as odd. As far as I knew, Calvin was Daisy's only uncle, and it seemed natural to assume they'd established a relationship over the years. Not so, judging by their manifest uninterest. Neither acknowledged the presence of the other by so much as a nod or a wave. "What's the deal with you and your Uncle Calvin?" "Nothing. We get along fine. Just no warm, fuzzy feelings between the two of us. When I was growing up, he and my aunt made very little effort to maintain contact. It's been so long since I've seen my cousins, I doubt I'd recognize them." "Mind if I talk to him?" "About what?" "Just some questions I have." "Be my guest." Calvin Wilcox watched without expression as I approached. I saw him flip aside his cigarette butt, and then he leaned forward and turned off the radio. Up close, I could see he hadn't shaved that morning, and the stubble along his jaw was a mixture of gray and faded red. With his ruddy complexion, his green cotton shirt made his eyes look luminous. As before, I felt I was looking at a version of Violet, same coloring, opposite sex, but electric, nonetheless. "Looks like you pulled a rabbit out of a hat," he said when I reached the open driver's side window. "How'd you come up with this?" The question seemed ever so faintly hostile, but I smiled to show what a good sport I was. "I'd say dumb luck, but I don't want to be accused of false modesty." "I'm serious." "Me too." I went through my standard explanation, trying a variation just to keep the story interesting. Someone saw Violet's car parked out here the night she disappeared. After that, it was never seen again. So it dawned on me maybe it hadn't gone anywhere. In retrospect, it seems dumb I didn't twig to it before. Who saw the car? I went through a lightning-quick debate with myself and decided naming Winston was a very bad idea. It was as Detective Nichols had said. The less information in circulation, the better. I waved the question aside. "I don't remember offhand. It's one of those things I heard in passing. What about you? How'd you hear about this?" I asked, indicating the excavation. "I was listening to the radio on the way home from work when it came on the news. I called the sheriff's office as soon as I got home." "Were you out here last night?" "For a while. I wanted to see for myself, but the deputy wouldn't let me get anywhere near. They knocked off at 10 and said they'd be starting again this morning at 6. "You have a guess about how long it would take to dig a hole that size? I'm talking way back when." "I don't know the details. You'll have to fill me in." From the scuttlebutt yesterday, the guy made a long, shallow ramp. 8 feet wide and maybe 15 feet at its deepest point. The back end of the car is buried at the bottom, with the front on an incline about like this. I held my arm out at roughly a 30-degree angle. He sat, blinking, while he ran the numbers through his head.
I'd have to do the math to give you any kind of accurate answer. In 1953, the guy would have used a bulldozer. If you're telling me he backed the car in, then he must have dug the hole with a long, sloping ramp on either end and scooped out dirt until the hole was deep enough at its deepest point to sink the car completely. I'd say 2 days, maybe a day and a half. It wouldn't take long to fill it in again. Someone must have seen what he was up to, but he might have had a cover story.
The 4th fell on a Saturday that year, so most people were given Friday off, too. If the road crew was idle for the 3-day weekend, then the excavation could have been done without anyone on hand.
I could see that, he said. With the road unfinished, there wouldn't have been any traffic to speak of.
What about the excess dirt? Wouldn't there have been quite a bit left over when the hole was filled in? He fixed his green eyes on mine.
Oh, yes. The car would have displaced somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 cubic yards of dirt. Rough guess.
So, what did he do? Haul it all away?
Not likely. The biggest dump truck in operation back then had a capacity of 5 cubic yards. So it would have taken way too long, especially if he ferried the load any appreciable distance. The easiest solution would have been to push it across the road and spread it out on that field.
But wouldn't someone have noticed the sudden appearance of all the fresh dirt?
Not necessarily. If I remember correctly, the field you're looking at belonged to a co-op at the time, and it was only being cultivated intermittently. With road construction underway, things were already torn up, so no one would have paid attention to them. A little more dirt.
We have to be talking about someone who's worked in construction, don't you think? The average Joe doesn't jump on a bulldozer and dig a hole that size. Seems like you'd have to know what you were doing.
True, but that's not going to help you narrow the field. After World War II, a lot of guys around here worked construction, Foley being one. Building trade was booming, so it was that, farm work, the oil fields, or the packing plant.
Well, I guess we don't have to worry about it. I'm sure Detective Nichols will figure it out. At noon, I took Daisy's car and made a run to the delicatessen I'd patronized the day before. Since Tanny had commandeered yesterday's Braunschweiger on rye, I ordered one for myself. Daisy said she'd be happy with whatever I picked up, so I had the counterman put together a sliced turkey sandwich on sourdough bread. I ordered a second one and then added potato chips, sodas, and a bag of cookies. As long as we were stuck there, we might as well enjoy ourselves. We ate in her car, watching the excavation as though we were at a drive-in movie. A tow truck appeared, the most exciting occurrence in the past 3 hours. Tom Paget must have gotten bored because I saw him back away and start heading in our direction. He had his fat-stemmed glasses in hand, polishing one lens with a white handkerchief. His jeans, cowboy boots, and western-cut shirt gave him the air of a rodeo rider, complete with slightly bowed legs. I said, "Hang on." I opened the car door and got out. "Hi, Tom. Are you off to lunch?" "Come again?" He put on his glasses and cupped a hand to one ear. "I wondered if you were on your way to lunch." "Yes, ma'am. I thought I'd grab a bite somewhere." "I can save you the trip. We have an extra turkey sandwich, if you're interested."
"That'd be nice if you're sure it's okay."
"If you don't eat it, we'll have to toss it out." He used the front fender of Daisy's car as a makeshift picnic table. I popped open the remaining soda and passed it to him. He shook his head to the offer of potato chips, but later accepted a cookie that he downed with enthusiasm. I said, "How's it going? You've managed to get a lot closer to the hole than we have." He cleared his mouth and ran a paper napkin across his lips, nodding as he did.
"They're making good progress. Looks like they're about to try pulling the car out of the hole."
"Really? That close?" He wadded up his sandwich wrappings.
"That's why they got the tow truck. Might not work, but it'd sure be a lot easier than what they've done."
"How long did you hang around last night?"
"As long as I could. I had paperwork to catch up on, so I left before they called it a wrap. I was surprised how much they'd accomplished. A lot of dirt.
Was it your equipment they were using when the road was built?
Sure was. Those days, there were only two of us. Me and a fellow named Bob Ziegler. Road construction, the county hired private companies like us. So we took advantage of the need. We were competitors, but neither of us had enough equipment to cover the whole job. Most of what I carried was tractors, and he was already spread thin because there were so many housing tracks under construction.
How'd you get into the business in the first place?
I could see the niche, and I decided to step in. I borrowed from the local yokel bank and hit up family members for as much as I could. First thing I did was pick up a couple of used farm machines. I didn't have an office or a yard. I worked out of a truck I kept parked beside a public pay phone and did the mechanical repairs myself. Heavy equipment's low margin, high volume, so every cent I got went right back to the John Deere factory to buy more equipment. Gradually, things picked up. Around here, what with the old boy network, you could slip a few bucks to a private contractor and you were set. At least for a while.
You have a guess about what the guy used to dig the hole? Calvin Wilcox says a bulldozer.
Had to be. 1953, the bulldozer or a track loader would have been the only mobile equipment available. The track loader was new technology in those days. I believe Caterpillar brought one out in 1950, but it was too expensive for me. And if Ziegler owned one, I'd have known about it. So, a bulldozer, for sure.
One of yours?
Had to be mine, or his. We were the only game in town.
You wouldn't, by any chance, have records going back that far.
Can't help you there. You're hoping I can tell you who rented that machine, but no dice. I keep records for as long as the IRS requires, and after that, files get tossed. 7 years back is the extent of it.
Too bad.
I'm surprised Detective Nichols lets you nose around like this. He strikes me as the type to run a pretty tight ship.
Right now, we don't even know what we're dealing with.
I guess that's right. Far as I know, there's no law against burying a car. Same token, sheriff's office can get pretty testy about people messing in their business.
Happily, I'm not messing in their business. Detective Nichols knows anything I learn will go straight back to him. I made a promise. We heard the steady peep, peep, peep of a vehicle backing up. The tow truck driver had the door open, and he was leaning out so he could see where he was going. Most of the law enforcement personnel had assembled near the hole. Detectives, deputies, and crime scene techs. Daisy seemed rooted to the earth, but both Paget and I crossed the road to get as close as we could. There was some dickering around while the cable was secured to the front axle of the car. I could hear the high whine of the hydraulic lift, and the cable pulled taut. With a groan, the car was wrested from the earth and hauled, rattling and banging, up the long incline. When the vehicle finally rolled into view, the tow truck driver pulled on his emergency brake and got out to take a look. The sad remains of the Bel Air hunkered in the light, like some hibernating beast whose rest had been disturbed. Moisture had chewed into the rubber on all four tires, leaving them flat. The rust was so extensive that the exterior paint might have been any color. The backseat window on the passenger side was gone. On the same side of the roof, the weight of the soil had caused a portion to collapse, leaving it looking as soft as a rotting melon. Dirt must have filtered into the interior, creating the depression that I'd seen from the second floor of the house. Though we couldn't see anything from where we stood, we were later told that condensation had caused the upholstered seats to decay down to the springs. The windshield and hood were intact. But the gas tank had rusted through, and all the gas had leaked out, visible as a darkened patch at the bottom of the hole. Even from that distance, I picked up scents, as subtle but unmistakable as a whiff of skunk, rust, rotting upholstery, and decomposing flesh. One of the techs blew on the windshield, managing to clear a small patch of glass. He directed the beam from a heavy-duty flashlight across the interior. He moved to the missing rear window so he could peer into the back seat. Daisy turned away, gnawing on her thumbnail. The tech motioned the detective over, and he peered in. While the second tech took a set of photographs, Nichols approached Daisy and eased her away from the rest of us. He talked to her for some time, his manner serious. I knew the news wasn't good. I could see her nod, but she made very few comments in response, her expression impossible to read. He waited until he'd assured himself that she was okay before he crossed back to the tow truck. At a signal, the car was loaded on the deck and secured with heavy chain. Daisy returned. Her face was drawn, and her eyes held the blank look of someone who hasn't yet made sense of the world. What's left of the dog is on the floor. They can see skeletal remains in the back seat. The body's wrapped in a shroud of some kind, though most of the fabric's rotted away. Nichols says they won't know cause of death until the medical examiner takes a look at her. I'm sorry. It gets worse. He says the shroud looks like badly disintegrating lace, probably a curtain, judging by the row of broken plastic rings they can see along one edge. Chapter 26. We drove back to Daisy's house. My impulse was to have her drop me off so I could pick up my VW and head for home, but she asked me to go with her to tell her father about the discovery of Violet's body. I wasn't sure she'd fully absorbed the impact of her mother's death. Under the surface calm, she had to be in a fragile emotional state. She'd longed for closure, but surely not this kind. Though she hadn't said as much, she'd probably had her hopes pinned on the notion that Violet was still alive, which would have afforded them the option of reconciliation. The certainty about Violet's fate created more questions than answers, and none of the options seemed good. In the meantime, ever practical, I made a quick dash inside and moved the clothes from the washer to the dryer so I could have my jeans back before I hit the road. We drove to Cromwell in Daisy's car, and when we pulled up in front of the rectory, we could see Foley sitting on the porch in a wooden rocker, his hands in his lap. In the aftermath of the assault, his face looked painfully swollen. His cheeks and eye sockets had ballooned up as though tight with air, and his bruises were a deeper shade of dark blue and more widespread. He'd showered and his clothes were fresh, but the packing in his nostrils and the splint on his nose had precluded washing his hair. A residue of dried blood matted the strands. Watching us approach, Foley had to know the news was bad, in the same way you know you're in for a jolt when a somber-looking state trooper comes knocking at your door. Daisy stopped a few feet short of the porch. Has anyone told you? No. Pastor said there was a call, but I refused to take the phone until I heard from you. They found her buried in the car. ID hasn't been confirmed, but the dog was buried with her, and there's no doubt as far as I'm concerned.
How was she killed?
They won't know until the autopsy tomorrow or possibly the day after.
At least she didn't leave us. I take comfort in that.
Not in the way we thought.
Do you think it was me that harmed her?
I don't know what to think.
I did love her. I know you don't believe me, but I loved her with all my heart.
A tear trickled down each side of his face, but the effect was odd, like he'd suddenly sprung pinhole leaks. Personally, I thought it was the wrong time to try defending himself. Daisy didn't seem receptive, and she sure wasn't interested in seeing him play victim. We all knew who the real victim was in the overall scheme of things. That's no way to love, Daddy. With a fist? My God! If that's what love is about, I'd just as soon do without.
It wasn't like that.
So you say. All I remember is your punching her out.
I can't argue the point. Sometimes I hit her. I don't deny the fact. What I'm saying is you can't fix on one part and think you understand the whole. Marriage is more complicated than that.
You better hire yourself another lawyer, Daddy, because I'll tell you it's complicated. She was wrapped in a lace curtain, and the dog's skull was crushed. In the car driving back to her place, I kept my mouth shut, sensing she was in a dangerous mood. Finally she said, "I swear to God, if he killed her, I want you to nail his ass." I wish it were that simple, but it's not up to me. This is a homicide investigation, and believe me, the sheriff's department doesn't need my help or interference. I may be a licensed PI, but that cuts no ice with local law enforcement. The quickest way to alienate the cops is to tromp on their turf. Daisy's face seemed set.
"You owe me a day. I gave you a $2,500 retainer. $500 a day for 5 days. And you've worked four."
"Well, that's true."
"One day. That's all I'm asking for."
"Doing what?"
"I'm sure you'll think of something. I understand what you're saying about the sheriff's department. But at this point, you know more about the case than they do."
"True again," I said. I had my own curiosity to satisfy, and I was already thinking of ways to do it that wouldn't entail stepping on their toes. In times past, I may have been a teeny, tiny bit guilty of crossing the line, but I was feeling virtuous this round, so far at any rate. When we reached her house, I slipped my jeans on, hot out of the dryer, gathered my toiletries and the few remaining articles of clothing, and shoved it all in a plastic bag. I grabbed my shoulder bag, tossed both bags in the back seat of my car, and backed out of the garage. It was Saturday afternoon. Government offices were closed, but the Santa Maria Public Library was open and might be worth a look-see. I drove into town, heading north on Broadway as far as the 400 block, where I pulled into the parking lot. The library is housed in a two-story Spanish-style structure with a ubiquitous red-tile roof. Santa Teresa architecture shares certain similarities with Santa Maria, though much of the latter looks less than 25 years old. I hadn't seen an old town, or anything resembling the mix of Spanish, Victorian, post-Victorian, craftsmen, and contemporary houses that Santa Teresa boasts. Many neighborhoods, like Tim Schafer's, date to the 50s, 60s, and 70s, decades in which single-family residences were miraculously charm-free. Once inside, I asked for the reference department and was directed to an elevator that took me to the second floor. My first job was to pull the roll of microfilm for the Santa Maria Chronicle covering June 1, 1953 to August 31, 1953. I threaded the film through the machine and scrolled day by day looking for anything of significance. On a national level, June 19th, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were executed at Sing Sing. During that same period, the cost of a postage stamp rose from 3 cents to 5. There was apparently new hope for a truce in Korea. On the local scene, according to the advertisements, gas was selling for 22 cents a gallon, a loaf of bread cost 16 cents, and a 16-ounce jar of Kraft Cheese Whiz cost 57 cents. Livia Kramer had given a home demonstration party, whatever that was, and the ladies who'd been awarded prizes were listed. Cecil B. DeMille's Cleopatra, starring Claudette Colbert and Warren William, was playing at the local theater, along with a 3D movie called Buona Devil. Approaching the 4th of July weekend, I saw that the Santa Maria Indians had a game scheduled with the San Luis Obispo Blues at 8:30 in the Elks Field, and the 144th Field Artillery Battalion was having a 4th of July reunion barbecue. As I surmised, while many businesses were open on Friday, banks and government offices were closed. Eventually, I came across the article about Violet's disappearance, a copy of which Daisy had tucked in her file. I started printing out pages, beginning with June 30th and continuing into the following week. I went into a room devoted to genealogy and local history. I checked the volumes on the left-hand wall and located the county directory for 1952. The 1953 edition was missing, but I thought the 1952 data would be more useful in any event. I set my shoulder bag on the floor and took a chair at one of the tables. In going over my notes, I'd come across the map I'd sketched on my first trip to Serena Station. I'd met many people who'd been intimately connected to Violet, but I hadn't talked to those on the periphery. In a murder investigation, anyone with something to hide could lie, obfuscate, or point a finger at someone else. A disinterested observer was a better source of information. Serena Station was accorded 2 pages in the city-county directory, roughly 60 families listed by address, name, and occupation. I counted 47 homemakers, 11 oil workers, a nurse, a bartender, B.W. McPhee, a ranch hand, 4 railroad workers, 8 laborers, a postmaster, and a teacher. Foley was calling himself a construction worker in those days, and Violet was listed as a housewife, not a homemaker, I noted. The Blue Moon, a laundromat, and the auto repair shop were the only businesses in town. The Sullivans' neighbors to the left were John and Bernadette Erickson, and on the street behind them, backing up to their rental house, was a couple named Arnold and Sarah Treadwell. One house down from the Ericksons, there was a family named Hernandez. I made notes, not knowing at this point what information would be worth pursuing. I spotted Livia and Chet Kramer's names, but no family named Wilcox or Ottweiler. I checked the 5 pages devoted to the small town of Cromwell, spotting both sets of names. Businesses there were more numerous, but still covered